This is WBEZ, National Public Radio, Chicago.
The views expressed on the following program are those of the participants and do not necessarily represent the views of WBEZ management.
1980. This past week in politics, the war between Mayor Byrne and the Chicago Tribune heated up. Ronald Reagan seized control of the tax cut issue, and the IVI IPO endorsed Bernard Carey's bid for re-election. Well, tonight on Inside Politics, we'll explore these stories and also take the political career of Illinois Attorney General Bill Scott. Good evening, everybody. I'm your host, Bruce Dumont, and joining us this evening on our premiere broadcast to discuss the week in politics, we have Bill Cameron, political editor of WMAQ Radio, a veteran City Hall reporter and Chicago political commentator for the NBC Radio Network. Also joining us this evening, we have Phil Crone, who for the past few years has been one of the leading political strategists for local Democrats here in the Cook County area. He is a former Republican who once served the Cook County Republican Party and a former speechwriter for New York Mayor John Lindsay. And our third guest this evening is Thomas Roser, Vice President of Government Relations for the Quaker Oats Company, President of the City Club of Chicago, and Chairman of Project LEAP, which stands for Legal Elections in All Precincts. And this is the first in a series of programs, and we thank you very much for joining us this evening. Our telephone number is 236-1531. This program is for, by, and about political animals, and if you consider yourself a political animal and would like to join the discussion, be my guest. 236-1531. If you have questions or comments for Tom Roser, Phil Crone, Bill Cameron, or about any one of the issues that we will discuss this evening. And I must also, at the beginning of the program, offer a sincere thank you to Mayor Jane Byrne, Jay McMullen, and the Chicago Tribune and all of Chicago media for making the first week of Inside Politics really kind of an easy show, because there is so much to talk about. And I would like to begin by talking a little bit about to Bill Cameron about the situation over at City Hall, because you have been involved in watching City Hall for the last 10 years in the Chicagoland area. Have you ever seen a week quite like this before, Bill?
Oh, of course.
How recently?
I mean, this is just another stage show in Chicago that makes politics the most entertaining thing there is in town. I wouldn't inhale too deeply on this one. We've all been getting a kick out of screaming First Amendment. And Jay Byrd, the press secretary, has been getting a kick out of needliness by moving in seven new desks and moving out the water cooler and the TV and the couch and the coat rack. And it's kind of like a domestic quarrel, but it's nothing to inhale too deeply on.
Well, there was a report late today that someone came in and offered you iced tea. Is that true?
That's right. The mayor, before her news conference this morning, said, "I brought up some iced tea in as much as I've moved your water cooler out. It's 8 feet away, I know, but it'll be closer if you just come on up here and have some ice in a glass and have some iced tea." And there were no takers.
No takers.
As a matter of fact, when she came back later and said, "By the way, did anybody have any iced tea?" Nobody said yes, and she wondered to Ray Hanania of Chicago South Town Economist why it was that
maybe you could
we didn't take iced tea. And the reason was, Ray said, was we thought it was Kool-Aid, which was a reference to Jim Jones.
Phil Crone, what about you? This has been a wild week. You have been inside and around the Democratic circles in Chicago. You are not, although you have an acquaintance with the mayor and Jay McMullen, you're more or less associated with the opposition front and Richie Daley. What's your reaction to what's happened in the last week? Are you sitting back just laughing at all this, that the mayor continues to get herself in trouble?
Well, I'm not so sure that the mayor got herself in trouble. To begin with, while everybody's in favor of the First Amendment and democracy, at the same time, everybody likes to see the press get kicked around, too. And I didn't see that any suits were filed. There were more promises and threats. I mean, it was one of those situations where on Friday or Saturday, she said they were going to be kicked out, and on Monday, she said that all they were going to do was just label the Chicago Tribune as a squatter. So it provided a good deal of ink and opportunity for political analysts to have an easy column to write or an easy commentary, and how can anybody hold anything like that against her?
What's been the reaction by the other members of the City Hall Press Corps to the new members of your group, including members of the Gay Life newspaper and also a number of the ethnic papers?
Yes, they began showing up today, as a matter of fact. We had some doubts as to whether they'd even show up, but some of them are beginning to show up, and I would have a hunch that most of them will be there a week or two, and then we'll have a room primarily full of empty desks. But Phil said here that it's good to see the press get kicked around. Nobody got kicked around. Everybody's just having some fun right now. You know that. No one seriously thinks that the mayor or anybody else is going to kick the Tribune out of City Hall. If anything, come Election Day, the Tribune will kick Mayor Byrne out of City Hall. I just don't want anybody to get serious about this because it is not significant. It is not serious.
Tom Rosa, what's your reaction to what's happened this week in Chicago?
Well, what happened this week certainly didn't touch on me, but the week before, I made out with Jane Byrne, and I mean, I don't want you to take that in the way that I said it, but I did.
We got a scoop on the first show here.
I'll tell you, I'm the chairman of an organization that has never been allowed within four blocks of City Hall, Project Leap. And on a controversy involving punch cards, I took a position that we oppose punch cards. The next thing I know, the mayor called me up. We had a delightful tete-a-tete. We sat at her desk and everything else and sort of juggled the issues of war and peace. And she came down on my side of the issue, which is that she opposes punch cards. So I had the honor of being attacked, Phil Crone, by the chairman of the Board of Election Commissioners, by the Republican county chairman of Cook County, and by all sorts of people, including the IVI and IPO. But so far as Jane Byrne is concerned on this issue, she's neat.
Boy, oh boy, you're going to start a fan club for her.
Yeah, but you don't work for her.
That's right. That's right.
Not yet, but I mean, who knows? The way this is going on, I might be the deputy mayor.
You'd take the job?
For 4 days.
You would take it for 4 days, or you would last for four days?
July 4th.
That's right. That's right. Or April Fool's Day. I don't, I think that I sort of agree with the NBC reporter here that it is really a tempest in a teapot. I can't bleed and die the way our friends at the Tribune can for their rights. I think they're sort of big and they can defend themselves. And I just cannot see Jane Byrne in the role of the Ayatollah throwing them out. It just sort of is sort of ridicule to me. And I can't, there are so many issues that I can't worry about it.
Tom, you've spent part of the week out of the city. How has it been reported in the Washington Post and Washington Star and this morning in the Rockford
papers? Spent about 3 days in Washington, a day in New York, and a day in Rockford. And it was, if not banner line in the Washington Post, it was a regular concurrent, you know, just a continuing feature in Saga. Unfortunately, I think that that battle is not taken with the grain of salt that a lot of people has taken here. It's really a very strange situation, regarded there as a very strange situation. In Rockford, it's regarded with probably sort of an air of bemusement, but after all, they are planning to have their own president, so they don't really care in Rockford about what's going to happen to their mayor, to the mayor of Chicago.
Tom, when you say they're planning to have their own president, Is the feeling in Rockford very strong for Anderson, regardless of political stripe?
Well, you know, it sort of is different, and that's very interesting. Winnebago County, as you remember, Phil Crone, from your Republican days, was which in fact may return or has been or whatever. But Winnebago County was to the right of the Ku Klux Klan, and it was the heart of the John Birch Society, and a number of people still feel that John Anderson is a very difficult person to put up with. But if you regard Rockford as incipiently Key Biscayne, San Clemente, the home of the president when he comes back, there is a feeling of local pride. I think the feeling ends when one discusses some of Mr. Anderson's positions. But I spoke to a civic club there today, and I felt that there was hometown, sort of a Hyannis port of the Midwest, one might say.
I never thought of Rockford as Hyannis port.
They are starting to think that way.
The Hyannis port on the Rock River.
Yes, that's right.
On the subject of your question, how are they perceiving it in the hinterlands? Whenever I file this story to the New York desk for the NBC radio, I always get the question, well, what has that lady done now? And there's usually a little adjective that goes before lady, which I won't pass along. But I think that it is regarded, in at least in our bailiwick, as rather entertaining, though you have to play it straight. When you put the tape of the mayor in, it takes on a whole new flavor simply because of the things the mayor says.
All right. One of the points that she's made over and over again is that it is the Chicago Tribune that is giving Chicago the bad name. But what I hear you saying, it's her reaction to situations.
No, I think it's a classic case of both sides are wrong, dead wrong.
Okay.
The Tribune is out to get the mayor. I don't want any doubt to be felt about that. I think you'd all agree. But I would also say that the reaction of the mayor has been an overreaction. It's been a reaction of right from the hip, without any thought as to, well, how are we going to get the Tribune reporter Bob Davis out of the press room? Well, let's not worry about that. Let's just order him out.
Why is the Tribune out to get Mayor Byrne?
Well, the Tribune is out to get Mayor Byrne, I suppose, because they have accumulated some stories that have committed them to a posture of whoever out there in our reporting staff has got something negative to say about the mayor, let's go with it. A Tribune reporter, who shall remain nameless, said to me the other day, well, I don't think there's a concerted effort to get the mayor or to make sure that she is beaten in the next election. But I do know whatever I offer to the desk that's anti-Byrne, they will run with. And I am inferred from that that whatever I offer that is pro-Jane Byrne will not be run with.
Phil, can you add any insight into that thought? Based on your knowledge, I mean, you're close friends with a lot of people of the Tribune. You're also close friends with Don Rubin, who is the representative, the legal representative of the Chicago Tribune. Well, what can you add to this controversy?
Well, without giving away any confidence of friendship, I have never heard personally a negative word expressed by Don Rubin concerning the mayor or the press secretary.
And never, ever?
No. Some bemusement occasionally, but nothing.
We're going to elaborate on that.
No, but nothing that would be considered derogatory or frankly nothing that couldn't be said to their faces with a few laughs. Like, I didn't get a chance to talk to him, but I left a message with Jay the other day. As a matter of fact, Dorothy Collin picked up one half of my suggestion. I made the point that the ceiling in the press room was about 15 feet. And that if they wanted to create more space, they could sort of put a balcony, another tier up there. The top would be for smokers, because smoke goes up, and the bottom could be for non-smokers. I also suggested that perhaps, because now the desks were getting so large, there was no place to walk on the floor, that they might have to change the size of the desk like a schoolroom. And then Jay could come down
and
assign the seats on the basis of behavior. Remember when you were in fourth grade, and the
yes,
teacher would say, you're the best boy, Bruce, and you can sit in the first...
And when I read Dorothy's column and she described you as a political operative, I knew exactly gave her that line.
I don't like particularly operative, but I don't think there was that much
form source.
I got to call this fellow on one thing here. He says he's never heard a disparaging word from Don Rubin about Jane Byrne.
Not since she's been mayor.
Well, I suppose that's true. And I was going to refer you to Taxi Gate.
Oh, well,
in which she attacked
him. That's ancient history.
Well, that betrays a feeling, however, and very definite, that Don Rubin has about Jane Byrne.
Well,
I mean, do you remember how he alluded to her emotional stability in the tightest days of Taxigate, if that word is correct?
Well, let's put it this way. There were a lot of pressures on everybody, and if you remember, at the worst time, she was unemployed. Her friend and later husband was on leave from the Sun-Times, not on leave, but actually had been laid off, I think, as a result of the Daily News going out of business.
Harriet Shattuck was taking care of him.
I'm not so sure.
Sure.
I don't know. Well, I
you
don't have that.
Did PR
knowledge.
For Harry.
Pardon?
Jay did PR for Harriet Shattuck.
Well, I'm glad that somebody took care of him. But, the thing that I really enjoy about the mayor, and everybody can say what they want, they say she can't get competent help. I dare say that I don't know too many people in this town who wouldn't take a position if it were still offered by the mayor of Chicago. Frankly, it's more exciting. It's like going to the Indianapolis 500.
Either that, I mean, or playing Russian roulette.
Well,
they're
not calling you the average bureaucrat. I mean, she has elevated people to a renown that they would not have otherwise had. And I think in some instances she's been very justified. Like, without saying anything personally against Lou Mazzotti, if I had been in her position, I would have done the very same thing to him, because he began to operate as if he were her Disraeli and she were Victoria, and she wasn't going to meddle in the actual operations. This lady makes decisions, and whether people like it or not, they're going to have to face the fact that if they want something done or they don't want something done, and it's in the borders of the city of Chicago, and it's something that's going to be acted on prior to 1983 at a minimum, they ought to try to have the discussions with her directly, or at least clear it with her.
Are each of you close enough to the average person on the street to judge how they are reacting to Jane Byrne? Tom Roser?
Well, I think the average person on the street probably now would be have a mixture of feelings about her. You'll notice that I'm soft on her now, and I criticized her.
She did a favor for you last week.
You've been in her den, and she's right. She's massaged.
She put the fix in for you.
I think that the average person says that she is inconstant in the sense that her decisions are made quickly and frequently changed, but there is an attitude, I think, of puzzlement about her. But I think the third thing is that they feel that she's standing up to the big tigers of this town, and whether rightly or wrongly or whether she's correct, I think there's a perception that she's a feisty lady who just pulls no punches, and I think that's a plus. I think that part of it is a plus. I think she has to gain control of the policy-making mechanism. Really, I think what she ought to do is not throw the press out of the press room, but just forget that they're there and go about and do her work and try to build a strong party organization and let the press cover what they wish.
But she said she was going to do that a couple of months ago, or at least Jay McMullen said he was going to do it, that she wasn't going to have the pickup news conferences. She was going to keep her mouth shut. She was going to engage in one-on-one interviews with radio, television, and newspapers. And she did that for about a week. She didn't get herself in any trouble that I can recall, but then she fell back and she decided to go with the pickup news conferences again, which is when she usually flies off with the lip.
I think the polls are wrong. I think people still like her. And I think anything you can put in the category of Jane Byrne shaking up City Hall or fighting the establishment, including the press, people love it.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I have obviously great regard for the Tribune and some very good friends over there, especially on the editorial staff. In terms of a posture, if I were advising the mayor and you had to have an enemy, I can't think of a better than this big monolithic Gothic tower, the ghost of Colonel McCormick, and this big newspaper trying to run the city where all they should be doing is writing about it or giving their opinion on an editorial page. That's a good opponent for her if she has to run. As a matter of fact, if she can do in a mayoral campaign what in a sense was done during the primary race for state's attorney, whereas instead of having her opponent be the opponent, pick another opponent and say, do you want this to run Chicago, she's going to wind up getting a lot of support from the really little people. You know, people say, oh, she comes off badly in the polls. Well, frankly, maybe she does at this point. But I think if you did a really in-depth poll that went beyond how they liked her and they put her in the context of opposition and who's against her, she's going to have people back on her side again. I mean, this woman is probably, despite all her mistakes and shooting from the hip, comes very, very close to reflecting the psyche of the average person, the person who's been stepped on, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in many ways, I think she reflects more than any politician I've seen the gut instincts of a Huey Long. And I don't say that negatively. I mean, this woman, given 90 days before an election, would switch things around, and through all the commotion, she might say, and people will forget the bodies that were strewn, she'll say, I bit the bullet on the Board of Education, I bit the bullet on the unions, I did this, I did this, I did this, I did this, and people are going to forget that she said that she'll never, never, never talk to this one, or she'll never, ever, ever let this one in. That stuff will be forgotten. What will be remembered is the fact that she won.
Is she making all the decisions, or is Jay directing her to the extent that some newspaper reporters have suggested that he is the puppeteer?
That reminds me of the Esquire magazine article before she became mayor, in which Jay boasted that he could roll over in bed and scoop the Tribune when he was at the Daily News, implying clearly that when he was going with Jane Byrne as Commissioner of Consumer Affairs, that he could beat the competition with that source. I think that she loves him very much, and that he is the one person who is deeply loyal to her and advises her. And I think many of the ideas, including this one, of kicking Bob Davis out of the Tribune, out of the press room, it was his idea. Jay is a very loquacious, very unpredictable, very flamboyant fellow who doesn't worry about how we're going to do it, but let's just do it. Come on, let's do it.
So they do it.
And so they try.
Phil?
I've known Jay for 20 years, and I would be very, very surprised if I ever found out that he had done anything that wasn't dollar honest, despite what everybody says about him. You think he was the biggest dealer and wheeler and so forth and so on. I've known him to be scrupulously honest. And the reason I say that is because I have represented...
Squeaky clean.
I have represented some very high-paying clients in which he did
turned down the money. Is that what
he did the stories. He did great super stories, and there never was even a lunch or breakfast. I mean, if he were guilty of even 1% of what people like to weave about him, it'd be ridiculous. But getting back on what Bill said, it is a great love story. If somebody could really interview both the mayor and her husband, they would find out that this is probably the strongest alliance that there has been in terms of, you know, modern or even maybe medieval history, greater than anything in the Kings of England or Shakespeare. I mean, it is a great love affair.
Really have a way with words, Phil Cronin.
No,
times, next you would call it, as we Catholics say, the Holy Family.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you an interesting thing. And I'm not, you know, I was for Rich Daly, and I'm still for Rich Daly, and don't agree with her at all on that. But she's a very charming person. And that doesn't mean that she doesn't have the other side, too. I mean, I would not want to suffer her rapier. But the...
Your time will come.
Yeah, right. That's all right. I just hope she does it with a sharp knife so you don't notice it. I hate pain. But I want to say one thing about... It was during the taxi crisis, and I represented the taxi companies at the time, and of course she was the main source of the charges against the companies, having just been commissioner of consumer sales. And I happened to be in the East, and it was a week after I represented. I mean, it was all headlines, so this was, say, the first week in January of 1978. And I was driving east on the turnpike, and a Tribune reporter read me the galleys of the Esquire story. And he said, what do you think of that? And I said, well, first of all, I wouldn't make any public comment because Jay's a friend of mine. But I'll tell you what, they're going to get married. Because after that thing in Esquire, she's going to say to him, this is it, you're going to get married, or it's off. And 2 months later, March 17th, they got married.
That nickname, McMullen and Wife, that was ballyhooed this week, that's very apt, I think.
But she makes you can say anything you want. Sure, he's the number one advisor, and she would trust him more than anybody. I suppose the next person would be her brother. But she makes the decisions, and I don't think she'd ever pass it off on Jay. He can say anything he wants, he can make any suggestions he wants, but ultimately, I think she consciously makes the decisions.
I have the same feeling that she does it. After she saw us on the punch card thing, she decided right at that spot Jay wasn't around, and I'm not sure Jay really was involved in that decision, and for good or ill, she made it. I think also, with respect to the power of the press and don't cross the Tribune or they'll get you, both the Tribune and sometimes in the Republican primary endorsed John Anderson for the nomination, and that carried a lot of weight. Did it or did it? It didn't. So I just think this idea that you can... cross the great media lords at your peril is a lot of baloney. I think I agree with whoever said that the average person is, really delighted when somebody does cross the media, and I think she succeeded in doing
that. She is also picking up, though, some pretty heavy complimentary reporting as well. I mean, Mike Royko has said some complimentary things in recent days. Walter Jacobson has been extremely complimentary, or at least he's been antagonistic towards the Tribune, at least in three commentaries in the last couple of weeks. So, I mean, it isn't all, everyone in the media is not against Jane Byrne.
And now, but what's interesting is that not only was Walter Jacobson giving good commentaries on the mayor this week, he was also giving good commentaries on Rich Daly, simultaneously interspersed, which means that Chicago is certainly a creative enough place that you can not only take different positions, but you can take them simultaneously.
The thing that bothers me about the whole thing really is that I'm not sure the media knows whether or not she really is governing. I talked to Don Hyder, who has a great prejudice about the electronics media. I asked him why he did not invite the electronics media in to interview him during his combat with him. And I'm not defending him, but he said, just plain and simple, the electronics media in this town doesn't have the energy to follow through some serious things without making a very dramatic point and getting involved in him and her. And he said, I'm bored with it. I'd rather have the print media do it and then have the electronics media follow through. I think probably what we ought to do is to consider how governance is really covered, because so many days have gone on with this absurd thing about Is the Tribune going to be canned or isn't it? When, in fact, I don't know, and I don't know anybody else in Chicago knows, how fair is the government of Chicago under her leadership? And I don't ask that prejudicially. I ask that from a standpoint of a person who really isn't told.
Bill Cameron.
We have been talking about a lot of tempests in the teapot, as Tom referred to them a while ago, and I think I would be remiss before we end this particular discussion if I didn't say, while we find Jane Byrne rather popular, notwithstanding the polls, all of this covers up a real minus, in my mind, about the Byrne administration, long forgotten, is that she has raised the taxes and fees $150 million on the people of Chicago, and that that's something that really does affect people, and it is lost in all of this much ado about nothing. Don't forget, she's hitting you right in the wallet, and she's hitting you very hard there.
I want to open the telephone lines now. Our phone lines are 236-1531. We've talked about the reaction of the public to Jane Byrne, Jay McMullen, and the battle that has been going on between her and her administration and the Chicago Tribune. We would like to give you an opportunity to respond and ask questions and react to what's been said thus far. 236-1531 is the telephone number. We're talking this evening with Bill Cameron, political editor for WMAQ Radio, a veteran of the City Hall Wars. He spent the last 10 years watching what's happening on the streets of the city of Chicago, the last 4 years as the political editor. He is also the producer and host of his own discussion program, Sunday nights at 9 o'clock on WMAQ, called Chicago News Conference, a show that makes a lot of news on a weekly basis. And he also was the creator and narrator on a record that came out a couple of years ago called Mayor Daily on the Record. He is also the political commentator for the NBC Radio Network. He watches what happens in the Chicagoland area. Phil Krohn is with us for the past several years. He's been one of the leading political strategists for local Democrats, including Neil Hardigan and Tom Hines and Senator Howard Carroll. And who am I missing? Not missing many. He was also at one point a Republican, having worked with Ed Kuharski when he was the Cook County Republican Party leader in the Chicagoland area. He's also a former speechwriter for New York Mayor John Lindsay. And our third guest this evening is Thomas Roser, Vice President of Government Relations for the Quaker Oats Company, President of the City Club of Chicago, a card-carrying Republican, and Chairman of Project LEAP. I'm Bruce Dumont. This is WBEZ Radio in Chicago. Back in 60 seconds.
Welcome to the National Public Radio Smorgasbord. Are you ready to order?
Yes, I think so. How about you?
No, I don't think so. You go ahead.
Okay, I'll have the jazz, please.
Ah, the jazz. And how would you like that?
Oh, alive.
And you, ma'am?
I'll have the Pauline Frederick
And colleagues?
Yes, certainly. And colleagues.
Very good. And madam, for you?
Why don't you come back to me later, okay?
I think I'd like to have the voices, please.
And how would you like the voices? Ground?
No, in the wind.
Fine. Excellent selection. And how about you, ma'am?
I'll have the options.
Would that be plain or an education?
Oh, either way.
Very good. And your order, please, ma'am?
There's so much to pick from. I'll take all things, and give me a large order.
Fine. Would that be considered?
All things considered.
May we have the bill now, please?
Oh, there's no bill. It's public. But we do accept tips.
The sound of National Public Radio can be heard on WBEZ, FM 91, Chicago.
Okay, we are back at 7:30. Good evening, John. You're on the air. Thank you for joining Inside Politics tonight.
Yes, I'd just like to ask your panel their comments on the state's attorney's race. If they think what the mayor will do about Rich Daley, will she campaign for him or work against him, or could she even possibly endorse Bernard Kerry in that race?
All right, let's turn to Phil Krohn because he is close. He is an unofficial advisor to Richie Daley. Phil, you want to react to that?
Well, first of all, I don't think the mayor is going to do anything politically. She said she isn't. Other than endorsing the entire Democratic ticket because she is a Democrat. I don't think she's going to endorse Bernard Kerry, although she said some pleasant things about him. I think that to the degree that people are Democrats and vote for Daley, he has that plus, and to the degree that people who don't want Mayor Byrne as a either unchallenged leader or even perhaps a future leader, they're going to be for Daley. If there are people who are violently for Byrne, then they'll be for Kerry. But I think demographically, at this point until November, Rich Daley has the better of those odds in terms of volume.
Bill Cameron, you want to comment on that?
I think she'll sit on her hands like she accused Mike Madigan of doing down in the General Assembly early in the game, because I think down deep in her purse, she would like to see Bernie Kerry reelected. A barometer of how she really feels about it, though, will be how much money from the Central Committee will go to Richie. And I have a suspicion, not much.
Tom Roser?
I agree with both of them. I can't add anything to that.
Okay, John, any other further question?
Well, I sort of made the comment in light of Jay's comments that he accused Rich of not being qualified and all that, and I wondered if that was really an indication. Was that the mayor speaking, or was that Jay McMullen speaking?
Anytime Jay speaks, it's Jay speaking.
Okay.
Great, thank you.
Thank you very much. 236-1531, if you have a question or comment that you would like to share with us about Mayor Byrne, Ronald Reagan, John Anderson, anything within the political spectrum, anything that has happened in the last couple of weeks, or a question you may have about things that are coming up in politics, do give us a call. 236-1531 is the phone number. Tom Roser, Phil Crone, and Bill Cameron are our guests, and let's go back to the calls. Hello, Liz. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Well, thank you, Bruce. Congratulations on your new show.
Thank you.
You know, it's fun and games to hear you people playing fun with Jay and Jane, and I love it. However, I do think there's some serious things happening here. And
can I ask you to speak up just a little bit louder?
Oh,
okay?
Sure.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I think there are some serious things happening here, and I remember quite clearly her telling me that Eddie Radoliak and the rest of those fellows were a cabal of evil men. What I'm getting around to now is the cable TV committee. They kind of scare me when I realize the power, the influence, and the money there. What people in the Chicagoland area see on cable TV is going to be a big influence in our lives. And I want to know if your experts can tell me who's going to watch the Foxes.
All right, let's go to Bill Cameron. He spends a lot of time around City Hall. What about the cable TV?
Fast Eddie had his first CATV meeting today at City Hall. They did some house cleaning chores and got some advice from Bill Quinlan, whose advice lately hasn't been the greatest. That's the mayor's chief attorney in the city. And something that Eddie said was rather interesting, and that is that he doesn't find any groundswell of support in his Steel District ward for CATV or alternative television of any sort as a source of entertainment.
You know what that means to me?
Well,
he hasn't bought the ground where they're going to put the dish yet.
Well, maybe so, but I don't think that he would have reason yet to lie about this sort of thing. He went on to say, therefore, we're going to apply to the Federal Communications Commission for a bigger take of the action in exchange for the franchises, not just 3%, as is typical, but 5% of the gross that the franchise earns. And he was very candid in saying, and you'll like this, if people aren't interested in for entertainment or programming so much, we may as well consider it just a revenue source and go out for all that we can get. Now, he was speaking in terms of the city when he said that. Perhaps you would have a more cynical view.
Yeah. If you believe that, you know how the story goes. You know what I've got to tell you. I'd like to hear what Tom Roser, I have always kind of appreciated his opinion.
All right, we'll let him respond. And we should also mention that one of the hats that Tom Roser wears is president of the City Club of Chicago, and they announced, I believe, either today or yesterday, that the City Club of Chicago will also have a committee that will explore the issue.
Yes, that's right. Well, we will have a committee that will explore the issue. I don't think I'm prepared to comment too much or to judge motivations. I spent a lot of time in Washington, and I usually like to see, and this is said without any kind of comparison to the city of Chicago scene, I enjoy seeing people who are duplicitous and have a reputation for being crooked sit down and write our tax laws, because I find that when they're properly watched, Senator Russell Long and Wilbur Mills and a couple of people like that did a good job. I find that when egregious mistakes are made, they're usually done by vacant-minded reformers who want to achieve things and really achieve sort of counter-reform. For example, a number of reformers decided a couple of years ago that they would have what they call sunshine laws in the Congress. That means that the American people would come in and watch our lawmakers write a tax bill. So what happened was that when they walk in to watch our lawmakers write a tax bill, very little happens. But behind the scenes, the unelected staff has far more power as a result of this and writes tax laws without any overview whatsoever. So I'm not making any judgments about Fast Eddie or anybody else, but I think that certainly the City Club will be watching them, and I appreciate your request, and I'm sorry I haven't answered it satisfactorily.
Well, just one general question. We talked earlier, you gentlemen talked earlier about her emotional stability. Will somebody please tell me how these evil men became water walkers so quickly? I'm very curious about that.
Bill Cameron, what about that? The evil cabal became friends, or at least friendly. Some people that even were not included in that group have come back, namely Ed Kelly. I noticed, according to one of the columns the other day, he lunched at Sweetwater with Jane and Jay.
They need each other. I mean, each gives the other something they need to remain in power and in authority. And all the reforms and all the utterances of the campaign are fine to get votes. But when you get right down to it, they all need each other to keep the power base, and so they do things for each other that lets them all remain powerful. I also want to say one other thing to you.
Yeah.
And that is, it's fun to talk about Fast Eddie and how he might be a crook, or it's fun to talk about Tom Keene in the same way, but they've, in the case of Berdiliak, he's always operated within the law, and you really can't call him a crook.
Oh, Lord. I think that's damning with faint praise.
Now, you can say Tom Keene went to prison, yes, but let's face it, Jim Thompson prosecuted him for political reasons. I'm not saying that is illegal or wrong. When the Democrats have the U.S. Attorney's Office, they prosecute the Republicans and pretty much vice versa, with a few token prosecutions of their own pedigree.
Well, when you say operating within the law, let's talk about the young man who killed the black baseball player and now is out. Because he convinced one group he was insane and then convinced another group he was not insane. Well, he operated within the law. That's why I refer to that as damning with faint praise.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like a little other qualifications to satisfy me, anyhow.
Well, sure. We should change the law then, but as long as the law is what it is, we can't call them crooks. That's just my journalism training.
There's one other thing that should be said in Alderman Verdoliak's defense. He is probably the biggest culprit in terms of his own reputation, because he's never made a concerted effort to do anything about it. But in my personal dealings with him, I have found him to, one, keep his word, two, be an individual of integrity, and probably most important of all in terms of discussing issues is that he's probably the brightest or one of the handful of the bright members of the city council. Now, if I were giving him political advice, I'd say, this is your opportunity to change the public perception about you. There's no doubt that he could become a quick expert in this field by reading the materials and talking to people where they've already had experience with cable TV, but I'm sure that if he comes out with a form of competitive bidding, minimum standards, public access, underserved areas, maybe linking the guy who gets the cables for Lincoln Park also has to have Woodlawn or Lawndale so that parts of the city won't be without service. I'm sure that if he does these things and has really open public hearings and where the decision is made on a rational basis, he has a great opportunity to change the perception about him. And I have a feeling that that's what he might be intending to do in this instance.
Well, almost you convinced me. I will watch the whole operation with joy and glee.
Is this Paula?
It's been fun talking to you.
Liz, thank you very much. Okay, bye-bye. Our telephone number is 236-1531. If you have a question or comment about politics, what's going on in the city, state, or nation, give us a call. David, you're on the air.
Very good. Listen, I want to ask some questions to either of you gentlemen. When our Constitution was first written and signed, did it give the President of the United States all the powers that the President derogates to himself these days for the past, well, I'd say for the past 15 or 20 years? Now, we have a man now, Mr. Carter. All right, what he did? He voted, he fooled around, and he gave the Panama Canal back to the people in Panama. That's one thing he did. All right, then he goes over and he lets all these people to come across here from Cuba, and he says that he can't do anything about it. He says, I can't stop them. What can I do about it? All right, but yet, the Cuban nation and the Mexican nation, they both say that if one American crossed their borders, they said that he won't get 50 yards inside their country before he's caught and turned back. Yet, now, if they can do that, as weak as they seem to be, why can a big nation like this prevent or control its borders about the people crossing its borders illegally?
All right, let's turn to our national affairs editor, Tom. Let's let Tom Roser respond to what you've said thus far, because he spends a lot of time in Washington, and national politics is his game.
Several questions. The answer to the first part, did the president, when the Constitution was written in 1787, have all the power that the president has now? Answer, no. Neither did the court, neither did the Congress. What happened is a series of precedents were set up, especially with the court, the Supreme Court, that really enhance power. I personally feel that, as a matter of fact, that the presidency had exhibited and exerted far too much power. I worry now that the presidency is not, because Mr. Carter is far too timid, is not exerting to the fullest measure the power that it should legitimately exert. With respect to the Panama Canal, while I disagree with Mr. Carter's view on that, I find that there was a vote, and that the minority leader of the U.S. Senate happened to agree with Carter, and that vote was taken, and it was conducted under constitutional processes. A challenge in the court, which was made by Senator Goldwater, was dropped because it was understood that the court could not challenge the action of the President and the Congress in that. So, essentially, I think while you can legitimately criticize those things, worry about the power of the presidency and worry about the power of the Congress and the decision of the Panama Canal, I think they were sort of circumspectly done and done under the province of the law. With respect to the unfortunate Cubans who are coming in here, I think that's a matter of some compassion. I think that all of us want to extend that sort of enlightened torch that the Lady of Liberty holds to people who have less sort of fortune than we, though. I don't know about you, but my people came under here, in here under very inauspicious circumstances.
But, Tom, isn't that a compassion that, for the most part, is pushed by the wine and cheese set, which you described as liberal Republicans and liberal independents and Democrats the last time you were on this program about a month ago? And what about the blue-collar people, the guys who will lose their jobs or who will not get jobs because of the influx of Cubans and other...
Well, I think that the hatred toward the Cubans that can come from the blue-collar set really duplicates the hatred of the blue-collar set, I think, of many, many generations before. The Anglo-Saxons, who felt that the Irish were the pigs of all time, according to the Boston Post. In this city, the Irish were regarded as the despised minority, the Jews, the all sorts of things. So I think that you're really seeing a duplication of that over and over again, and I'm sure that our blue-collar friends have a very keen resentment, and our phony liberal friends who live in all these sort of upholstered suburbs, who feel very condescendingly about the whole thing, don't have to share any of the problems. But I think, essentially, that the Carter administration has made a mistake in the way that they've handled some of the basics of the influx of our neighbors. I think first of all, Mr. Carter should not have said, "We welcome them," and then changed his mind a day later and said, "No, we don't," and then, "Yes, we do." That kind of, I think, misleading really has sort of hurt the American people and made us really have a very confused image. Beyond that, I think that certainly people who, after they're in this country for 2 weeks and are in a compound and are being treated, then storm the battlements and try to take over and try really to, in a sense, protest this, I think ought to be banned and ought to be kicked out if you can, because I think they aren't actually showing the kind of respect for our country that they should. It's a long answer.
David?
Well, yes. One more thing. Now, Mr. Castro is saying that he wants to send several thousand more over. He's saying he wants to send them, and he says that Mr. Carter can't stop him, can't prevent him from doing that. And I don't know what Mr. Carter will do. Now, in the first time, the mayor of Miami and the governor of Florida, they said, we don't want him here in our state. But it seems that although they were voted and elected as mayor and governor of Miami and Florida, it seems that Mr. Carter just seemed to overrun their power altogether. It seemed like that they were saying that they didn't have any authority over their own state and over their own city. He just brought them roughshod over there, and some of the citizens of Florida, I have a sister who lives in Miami, and she said that she's afraid to leave home now, afraid that said these people can just walk up down, just like a band of horses up and down the street, can break into people's homes at will,
That also led to the outbreak of the recent riot in Miami, the overall black frustration there as they saw the growing Cuban political power base there wield its power. And in Miami, the Cuban... political power of the Cubans is very strong.
I think this could be said, that we can't allow Castro to decide the immigration policies of the United States. I think our president has to lay down guidelines as to the admission of these people who should not be admitted, people who have difficulty. And I think this inconstancy that the president has really is misleading to the international community.
At least he is consistently inconsistent.
That's right.
David, thank you very much. 236-1531, if you have any question or comment. It does not have to be about local politics, where we've spent most of our time discussing this evening. If you want to move into state politics or also national politics, do give us a call. 236-1531. One brief discussion on the local level, and then I would like to turn to the national political scene, and specifically Ronald Reagan's move yesterday to kind of seize control of the tax cut issue. But I want to just spend a couple of moments on the endorsement earlier this week by the IVI and IPO of Bernard Kerry's bid for re-election. Phil Crone, you were at the meeting. I believe you were consulting with Richie Daley. Did it surprise you that Richie Daley decided to go there, and how well was he received?
Well, he was very well received in terms of reception. I mean, the civil reception, applause, and so forth. It was impossible for him to get the IVI endorsement because of a variety of things that were transpiring. To begin with, the endorsement shouldn't be overemphasized because Kerry has had it twice before. He was expected to get it this time. What I found interesting was that there were less than 100 people who came to the meeting, and of the 100 people, the most impressive members of IVI in terms of achievements and stature were for Rich. I mean, Senator Don Clark Netsch, former State Representative Bob Mann, former chairman of the organization, Steve Klein, Charles Bernardini, Monica Faith Stewart, State Representative Carol Mosley Brown, all spoke for Daley. But on the questioning he was asked on capital punishment, he was for capital punishment. Kerry personally opposed capital punishment. Daley admitted that he had supported right-to-life measures in the legislature and had voted for them. Kerry articulated a pro-choice belief. So these were key issues with IVI. And what was interesting is that Kerry only got 54 votes. 19 votes were for Daley and 13 votes were abstentions. Now, the truth is that most of those 13 votes could have been for Daley, but had they, then Kerry wouldn't have had the two-thirds, and it would have gone to the board, and then he would have gotten another endorsement. So the tactical decision was just let it ride and end it in one day. And thanks to Mayor Byrne, who allegedly is not, you know, hot about Richard becoming the state's attorney, her publicity vis-a-vis the Tribune sort of drowned out the IVI endorsement in terms of space. So
my next question was that 10 years ago, if the IVI and IPO, although they were separate organizations 10 years ago, if they would have made an endorsement, it would have been played up very big in the media. Does the IVI-IPO still have political clout in the precincts, or is it just a paper organization?
I think it still has influence, not as much as it used to. But it does have influence. It's helpful. It's certainly more helpful when it becomes a dog, I should say a man-bite-dog story. Had the IVI gone for Daley, it would have been terrible, if not irreparable, damage to Kerry. The interesting thing, though, and the people who were speaking for Rich Daley at this meeting, publicly speaking at the IVI, Senator Newhouse, too, I forgot to mention him, is that Rich has done...
Yeah, but you expected them to go for Daley. They're Democrats.
Well, wait a minute. They didn't go for Hanrahan, obviously, the first time, and they didn't go for Egan 4 years ago either. Kerry had significant black support 4 years ago. He's not going to have that support this time, and it's very important for him, obviously, as a Republican running in Cook County, to make inroads in that community. Now, I'm not saying that the average person is going to be just following leadership, but Rich seems to be getting an extremely good reception in the black communities.
Tom Roser?
I think in the past there has been a great deal of mischief attendant upon IVI endorsements of Republicans. One of our early callers talked about how corrupt certain people are without a lot of basis except rumor. I felt, as a former board member of IVI, I'm going to say something very heretical, I was always disturbed when I was on the board of IVI when some wealthy Republican friends with lavish campaign budgets came in and were endorsed and then, with their campaign donations, set up headquarters that the IVI ran and had staffs which were sort of paid by those people. Now, I'm not saying anything that the money meant a lot, but I was disturbed that in the case of Senator Percy several times, in the case of, not sure this is in the case of of Mr. Kerry, but that the plan was to give and to make donations, certainly in the case of Dick Ogilvie, and that was a mixed bag in that decision between Walker and Ogilvie, that large donations were made to IVI, that housekeeping was set up, that staff was hired, and it came to the benefit of IVI. Not saying their decision was swayed by that, but in this age, where one has to be Caesar's wife, I'm always suspicious at the kind of liaison between heavy contributors and IVI.
Well, Cameron, Tom, I think you'd be candid to concede also that back in the days of Simon versus Walker and then Ogilvie versus Walker, that much of those endorsements were bought and paid for with last-minute memberships, and the endorsement sessions became fundraisers for IVI, which was not then married to IPO. Today, that apparently is not so much the case if fewer than 100 people showed up, and the bottom line I would say on it is I can't get too excited about an organization which is really two organizations and can only muster fewer than 100 people, and the endorsement carries on 54 votes. To me, I wouldn't even report that because it's not significant enough.
I agree.
Let us go back to the telephone calls. 236-1531. Hello, Jim, you're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, good evening, Bruce. I have a series of questions I'd like to ask you and your guests. First, I'd like to know if the guests might speculate on who the successor might be to Bill Scott when he's sentenced in July.
Okay, that was going to be next up on our agenda, but we'll move into that discussion right now. Of course, it appears that Bill Scott's going to be the Illinois Attorney General at least for another month. Bill Cameron, would you like to speculate who might get his job?
It's tough to guess. I think it has to be somebody who worked with Thompson as U.S. Attorney who is not Sam Skinner. Sam had the bad taste to show up the day that Bill Scott was found guilty in the courtroom. And he has pulled himself out of the running even before any notion was seriously announced that he was in the running. There are several people to pick from, like a Dan Webb or someone like that, but it has to be someone who will commit to run the next time the election comes up and Scott's term is up. I think Thompson has indicated he knows who he's going to pick and will do so at an hour's notice, but he's giving no clue as to who that is. You can rule out Kokoris, Chuck Kokoris, who was the former ICC chairman, because he's going up to the federal bench, but it's going to be somebody like a Dan Webb, somebody like that.
Phil Crone, what does your... what do your inside sources say about Bill Scott's successor?
Well, if the governor wanted to appoint a very intelligent and honest individual and a person who has equal footing...
Bill, you're not a lawyer.
Wait a minute. No.
I'm sorry. I thought you were building up to yourself.
Equal footing with the governor and a person who's had experience working in the office as a deputy and a woman, he could appoint his wife. And then match City Hall. The governor and the attorney general married to each other in the state of Illinois.
Boy. That sounds like a TV series. Tom Roser?
Well, if I were Thompson, I guess I'd name a man who has the experience of working with him and also has a great deal of experience in elective politics, although he's never run, Jim Fletcher. As deputy governor, I found him eminently attractive and bright. He was a parliamentarian, I believe, for both House and Senate in the Illinois legislature. He's young, he's bright, he's a very good lawyer, attractive. He knows the political game, speaks well.
I just want to say, seriously, I'll tell you who I would appoint if I were the governor. I'd appoint Roy Sandquist. I think that would probably be the best possible appointment the governor could make of an individual for attorney general.
He ran in what? It was in 1964? He ran and lost?
Yeah, he ran. He won a very heavily contested primary to have the privilege of running with Barry Goldwater and Company in the fall.
Say what you will about Bill Scott, but isn't it a shame we're at this point one of the most popular vote-getters in the country, certainly in the state of Illinois among Republicans? I think he is the top, maybe now not because of Thompson.
No, he was better. I think he was better than Thompson in terms
of... He's still the all-time champ at the...
And certainly carried every county, maybe every precinct, God knows. Yeah, he was the champ.
He was the last Republican to carry the city of Chicago.
Right.
I don't know how you fellows felt about the indictment against him, but I thought it was a cheap shot, and it's too bad that it's brought this fellow down.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying there's nothing in Bill Scott's closet. There is something in everybody's closet, but... Or is he still in the hospital?
Frankly, it wasn't even in his closet. It wasn't a great shock to anybody who's knowing him, so it was unfair.
Yeah. And regardless of what you feel about Bill Scott as a political leader, we would certainly hope that he gets a speedy recovery, although perhaps
speedy recovery during under the pressure that he is currently under, perhaps is something that is just wishful thinking on everybody's part. You had another comment.
Bruce, I wanted to ask your guest, and specifically Bill Cameron, what they thought the future of public employee collective bargaining is. First in Illinois, there was a bill that was just recently defeated this year just by a couple of votes, which would have given the state its first public employee collective bargaining statute. Second in the city of Chicago, what the fate of that long-awaited but never presented collective bargaining ordinance is. And third, the question of collective bargaining at county hospital.
Well, as to the state, the vote gets a little closer with each passing year, but it's too expensive. I can tell you what Tom Keene told me after he came back from prison and Jane Byrne was assuming office and she had to make good on that promise in the city. That is the biggest mistake she ever made. And she's beginning to see that now. And that's why you see Jane Byrne delaying and delaying as to first the firemen and now any other group. You see no quick action or any elections being called among police organizations, for example, in the city, for them to somehow name a bargaining unit. She is exploiting their division among many associations to foster the disunity so that they don't have to choose a bargaining agent, which one day we'll have a contract to talk about.
Jim, on that note, we thank you very much for calling, and we do move on. We're talking with Bill Cameron, political editor of WMAQ Radio, Phil Crone, Democratic political strategist in the Chicagoland area, and Thomas Roser, who is vice president of government relations for the Quaker Oats Company and president of the City Club of Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. This is Inside Politics. Our telephone number is 236-1531. We will continue from WBEZ Radio in Chicago in 60 seconds.
You are tuned to your public radio station and the National Public Radio System. It's the spoken word, music, drama, cultural events, news, documentaries, international affairs. It's a global ear, collecting the sounds of people in action. It's unique, it's dynamic, and it's yours, National Public Radio.
WBEZ, National Public Radio, FM 91, Chicago.
The last third of Inside Politics continues with Bill Cameron, Phil Crone, and Thomas Roser. Our telephone number is 236-1531, but before we go too much further, a word about our program next week when we will be talking about the wheelers and the dealers and where some of the bodies, the political bodies, are buried in the Chicagoland area and where the real power is in the city. We're going to be talking with F. Richard Ciccone, political editor of the Chicago Tribune, Sheldon Gardner, former state chairman of the Independent Voters of Illinois, who we will give an opportunity to respond to what Tom Roser said about IVI just a few minutes ago, and also Timothy Sheehan, who is a veteran Republican, who is the ward committeeman of the 41st Ward, and he has certainly been through the wars, ran against Mayor Daley in 1959, I believe was the year, and he certainly knows his way around the political block as well. So next week, Tim Sheehan, F. Richard Ciccone of the Chicago Tribune, and Sheldon Gardner will be our guests on Inside Politics. Let's go back to the calls. 236-1531. Mary Lou, good evening.
Good evening, Mr. Dumont. I have two questions, one for Mr. Roser and one for Mr. Crone.
Okay.
I'd like to ask Mr. Roser why Project Leap did oppose the punch ballot. I never seemed to really get the details on that. And how did he defend the organization against the charge of self-perpetuation was its motive?
How did he
defend the organization?
That it was self-perpetuating.
Okay. The story of the punch card is simply this, that Project Leap did not oppose the punch card per se. It went on record as supporting the punch card with safeguards. The visit with Mayor Byrne evidently convinced her that the safeguards could not be applied in time. She then announced that, so far as she was concerned, she wasn't having any. A visit followed that with the chairman of the Board of Election Commissioners, who, after he stopped calling names and sat down, felt that in fact any meaningful safeguards probably couldn't be achieved in time. The board of Project Leap then submitted a number again of proposed safeguards and were almost enthusiastic about punch cards if they could be employed, but as I understand it, the Board of Election Commissioners chairman was not accepting that. with regard to Project Leap self-perpetuating itself by opposing punch cards so that we could continue to have vote fraud. We felt that, a number of us felt, that punch cards would lead to a rebirth of vote fraud, which would be very good for Project Leap in the sense that
computerized vote fraud.
We could warn about the possibility of a number of manipulations taking place. So, essentially, I think the press probably exaggerated the story of the opposition and underplayed the idea that we supported it with safeguards.
I see. Thank you. And I'd like to ask Mr. Crone, what is the status of the charges against Richard Daley now relative to the Fire Commissioner Quinn legacy?
The famous Quinn estate. It's been in all the papers and TV, Phil.
This is a politically motivated of the courts by a blood relative, but basically unknown to Mr. Quinn, against Rich Daley's son and his sister. I think everybody in Chicago has a modicum of knowledge of politics knows that the late Mayor Daley and Fire Commissioner Quinn were close boyhood friends and remained friends through life, and Quinn was a bachelor, and he was superstitious about death, and didn't have a will, and his mother died close to 100, and he had one brother who died, and when Rich Daley's son Kevin was born with serious birth defects, it affected Bob Quinn very emotionally, and he wanted to do something for that youngster, and he did it by putting his bank accounts in joint tenancy with Senator Daley for the benefit of Kevin, and because Pat Daley Thompson had been divorced and was also one of the favorites of Commissioner Quinn, he put in joint tenancy the house in Skokie that had belonged or had been used by his deceased mother. And there's a big brouhaha over it, and there's been a hearing. And what's most interesting is the Chicago Bar Association during the primary investigated all the records, and up to the point of the records in this hearing, they found that there was absolutely no wrongdoing by Rich Daley.
Bill Cameron.
I agree. Who more logical than Rich and Mike Daley would Quinn choose to exercise his finances? And while much can be made of, was Quinn in full possession of his faculties when this particular withdrawal was taken and that one, it's logical that Mike and Rich would act in his behalf, even if he was not in possession of his faculties. So I don't inhale on this too deeply either.
Okay. Mary Lou, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That brings up a question, which you just, because obviously this is one particular story that was touted primarily locally by Dick Kay of Channel 5, who had uncovered a lot of this material. Early in the program, we talked about how local politicians are lining up, some with Mayor Byrne, some with Richie Daley. Are members of the media lining up in camps? They wouldn't admit it publicly, but you've been around City Hall a long, long time, Bill Cameron. Are there pro-Daley and pro-Byrne people in the media?
I think, I'll be very candid on this. It's not that a reporter lines up behind a politician, but things like this happen. When Mayor Byrne gets very angry at the Tribune, she feeds stories to the Sun-Times. And what is the Sun-Times reporter to do? Say, no, I won't take your leak because I'm for a free press and I don't want you to use me at the expense of another member of the press. Of course he doesn't say that. He says, thanks for the story. And so it can develop that you can perceive one publication as, in some cases when it covers hard news, and I'm not speaking of the editorial page, that it seems to be pro-Byrne or anti-Byrne. That generally is not the case. Another factor that can lead to a perception that someone is pro-him and anti-her is that you might come up with a Bob Weidrich-type story where you have three former top police officials telling you that the mob exercises some influence over City Hall and the office of mayor. Well, when three top police officials walk up to you and say that, as a reporter, you cannot ignore that. You must run with that. And the realities of newspaper production being what they are, and circulation pressures being what they are, when you get three top cops saying that, you go with it in the Sunday edition, and you go big with it. And I think much of the brouhaha over that scandal, among others, like the one just last weekend on this compendium of old news about the Bolandic administration and how waste in politics had an influence, is the way the mayor's office reacts to it. You know, the reaction is better than the story. If she just ignored it, we'd have forgotten it by Monday morning.
You think she'll learn?
I think she is learning. I think she is guarding her words much more closely than she used to. I know that in my experience of covering her, she doesn't shoot from the hip nearly as much as she used to. She's still overreacting to big institutions like the City Council on occasion and the Tribune that you're seeing now. But I think much of what people attribute to her in unsavory adjectives is really an unpredictability that she is enduring and learning on the job. Let's face it, she had no experience in an enormous job like this, and she is painfully learning the importance of what she says. You know, here's a pretty good example. When she was commissioner of consumer affairs, she would say the most outlandish things, and we could ignore it to the point that we'd call up the victim of her charge and say, "Are you really watering your gasoline?" And he'd say, "No, that's just natural condensation. I've already taken care of that, but these birds are giving me tickets." And so we'd ignore it. Well, when she's mayor of Chicago, you cannot ignore anything she says.
And it was called the Friday.
Anything she says is news.
And it was Friday afternoon. The dean of the City Hall Press Corps has the Friday afternoon theory, which is that some of her biggest, most outrageous announcements, charges, or appointments, or whatever, occurred around between 2:30 and 4 o'clock on a Friday
afternoon. Absolutely.
Well, now, she's no dummy, because if it's really a good story, they're not going to blow it on the Saturday newspaper. It's a good banner for Sunday or a big Sunday story. But when she was commissioner of consumer sales, they had the Friday afternoon rule, which was anything that Jane Byrne said after 2 o'clock on Friday by common agreement would not go reported. Now, they'd say, well, of course we can ignore a commissioner, but you cannot ignore what the mayor says. So obviously,
I was literally driving to work on Fridays last winter, because the train schedule was so bad in my neck of the woods that there weren't enough trains to service me at 8 or 9 o'clock at night. And I had to be around because I just knew something would break.
There's another thing that you have to say about partisanship. You can take the attitude you're fighting with a public official and yet have a personal or private relationship that's different, if not even opposite to it. I guarantee you there are a few members of the press who were invited to the mayor's home for a cocktail party wouldn't go. I don't think she's got really bad blood with all but maybe one or two. Weidrich would be one that would come to mind, and I can conceive of her going up to him and saying, "Hi, Bobby." I mean, totally blowing his mind. She's got the capacity. I don't know if he would
He wouldn't think it was.
But it's one interesting thing, you know, with the press. I believe that most of the press would like to see Rich Daley get elected state's attorney, for several reasons. Not because they don't like Kerry, but that the whole idea of a Daley estate attorney with a Byrne as mayor is going to produce more of what their industry calls for, namely news and headlines.
And do you agree with that, Bill?
No. I'll vote again for Bernie Kerry because he's been a good state's attorney. I believe incumbents who do a good job warrant a vote for re-election. Perhaps other members of the media will go into that booth and vote their business. Other businessmen vote their interests in a lot of ways.
We should also mention, just on a personal note with you, Bill Cameron, that one of the reasons that Bernard Kerry is the state's attorney today was because in 1972 he appeared on your radio show over at WMAQ with Ed Hanrahan, and it was during the taping or right before the taping of that show that Ed Hanrahan blasted or made some derogatory statement about Mrs. Kerry, which got...
Yeah, Marietta Kerry was sitting right, 5 feet away, and here was Ed Hanrahan and Bernie Kerry next to each other, and they got so vindictive on the air, I had to ask him at one point, "You guys really hate each other, don't you?" I mean, it was awful. It was a call-in show much like this one, called Confrontation, appropriately enough. And Eddie's temper, he just takes everything so seriously. And he finally got up after the taping with, right in front of the Daily News, the Tribune, and the Sun-Times, and Chicago Today. This is 36 hours before the polls open, Sunday night before the Tuesday election. And he says, "How can you be married to that man?" And something else like this, which was a derogatory personal remark about a lovely lady who's the wife of Bernie Kerry. And everybody in the peanut gallery, the newspapers, heard it and ran with it like crazy the next morning. That, together with Mike Royko's column placing Ed Hanrahan at a award rally with John DeArco. Of course, Royko would cultivate the mob connection allegation to the hilt. Those two things were credited with turning the election around just a week after Eddie Hanrahan had been acquitted in the criminal case down at the criminal courthouse for the Black Panther raid.
Let's go back to the telephone calls. 236-1531 is the telephone number. Bill Cameron, Phil Krohn, and Tom Roser are our guests this evening on Inside Politics. And on the line with us right now is Ed. Good evening, Ed. Ed, are you still there? I guess Ed got tired of waiting.
I suppose it was Ed Hanrahan.
Could be. Either that or Ed Vidoliak. 236-1531 is the telephone number if you have questions or comments. Bill Cameron is here, political editor of WMAQ Radio. He is a veteran City Hall reporter and comments on Chicago politics for the NBC Radio Network. He also is the producer and host of Chicago News Conference, which is the successor program to the Confrontation Program that he just mentioned to you. That is heard every Sunday night at 9 o'clock on WMAQ 670 Radio on the AM dial. And it is an excellent program, and it's a program that makes a lot of news each and every day. Phil Krohn is also here for the past few years, one of the leading political strategists for the Democrats here in the Chicagoland area, including Tom Hines and Neil Hartigan and Dick Elrod and Senator Howard Carroll. He is an urbanologist. He also used to work for the Republican Party, spent a number of years as a Republican operative working for Ed Kuharski when he was the head of the Cook County Republican State Central Committee, and he is also a former speechwriter for New York Mayor John Lindsay. Tom Roser is here, Vice President of Government Affairs for the Quaker Roads Company, President of the City Club of Chicago, Chairman of Project LEAP, former Undersecretary of Commerce during the Nixon administration. You quit the Nixon administration before it was fashionable, is that correct?
I got fired.
Oh, you got fired,
which is
before it was fashionable.
On my resume every year.
And also, for a number of years, he served as an administrative assistant and a press secretary to the governor of Minnesota and also to Congressman Albert Quay, correct?
Okay. Very good.
Background in Republican politics.
Just as I gave it to you.
And a card-carrying Republican. Phil Krohn is a card-carrying Democrat, and Bill Cameron is a member of the press club. 236.
No, I'm not.
You're not. I didn't mean to throw that. That's right. They got bad lunches there. 236-1531. Ed, good evening.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Hi. Oh, we got cut off a minute ago.
No, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. I have a question about a national issue that's really surprisingly hard for me to get information on. It's, I don't even know how to refer to it anymore, but other than the son of S1, you should know what I mean?
Yes.
Okay. Surprisingly, you know, Kennedy is a prominent proponent of this bill.
This is rewriting the criminal code.
Senate
Bill 1.
Senate 1, okay.
Yeah, assume now it's an overwhelming expansion of police power and federal investigative power into, you know, what otherwise would have considered our private lives, more or less, and, you know, such as broad generalized definitions of conspiracy and on.
I think it's a little watered down compared to Senate 1, however.
Yeah, it's a little watered down to make it more palatable for the sake of getting it passed, I suppose, for political expediency. But I'd like to know if you could fill me in, because I'd like to know more about it. What are the, what is involved with it? And
everybody,
also, what are the chances of its actual material?
Ed, I think everybody is kind of shrugging their shoulders around the table. I will pass that on to you. I don't know whether anybody can really comment on the intricacies of Senate Bill 1.
The bill is so involved that I hesitate to, you know, really get into it because I don't have a briefing paper here. It wouldn't be fair to the authors of it.
Do you want a copy of it? Is that it?
Well, that would be nice.
Well, I would say
so
you could
write back to the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Right.
Washington, D.C., Senator Edward F. Kennedy,
right.
Chairman,
right.
Senate Judiciary Committee, Senate Office Building, Washington, D.C., and say you'd like a copy of the revision of the criminal code.
Yeah, well, does anybody on the panel know enough about it to talk about it?
No, they do not. They have all shrugged their shoulders.
Well, like everyone else, we've heard the rhetoric, and I'm afraid that, you know, beyond that, we don't have a copy of the bill. I don't have a copy of the report of the amendments of it and everything else, so we better not fool around with that one.
Okay.
It seems like in passing that the fact that it's so involved seems like a good defense for it because everybody is possibly intimidated or...
Well, nothing's going to happen this session.
Yeah,
because
there's a lot of bills that are...
It's going to die this session, I can tell you that.
Yeah.
Because
pardon me?
It won't pass this session.
No.
The reason it won't is very simple. If it passed the Senate, which it won't, because they're recessing. But if it passed the Senate, it would have to go through House hearings and House passage, and with an election coming up in November, there's no way that it can happen before December 31st or January 3rd when this Congress expires. So
okay.
I wouldn't worry about it.
Okay. Okay, thank you very much. And just write to the Senate Judiciary Committee, United States Capitol, Washington, D.C., and send it to Senator Ed Kennedy. Let's turn to national politics. We've got about 10 minutes left, and at the beginning of the program, one of the topics I said that we would discuss this evening is Ronald Reagan's seizure of the tax cut issue. Do you think he has been successful in that, or is it too early to tell, Tom Rosen?
Well, I think he's... I think actor Reagan is now moving from the Hellcats of the Navy stage that my friend Phil Krohn would always warn us about.
Bedtime for Bonzo.
The guy that is going to press the button, and Bedtime for Bonzo, which is the buffoon. And
wait a minute.
To,
have you any doubt that all politicians aren't actors?
That's right. To a stage where he is taking
on... He just got paid for it.
Yeah.
He sort of reminds me of the father barber of the old on a one-man's family thing. He is now becoming... a statesman. He has an advisory committee composed of all kinds of people in defense and the economy, and George Shultz, and he's pulling together sort of a centrist policy. The tax cut thing is a politically advantageous thing. I think that the way that he has handled the compromise between the Art Laffers and the Friedmans on that, and came in with a tax cut which goes in a series of steps is astute, just as the way that he handled Bill Brock's retention was astute. And I think that John Anderson, who is a man of great courage frequently, and I think by attacking the tax cut as he did very violently today and yesterday, is going to suffer as a result of it. And I wouldn't imagine Anderson, if he keeps up, is going to really be a factor that'll throw it into the House. That's my...
You think he will?
I do not think he will. I think he'll move down the ladder.
Phil, as in the past programs, and we should mention for those that are joining us for the first time this evening, Phil Krohn and Tom Roser have been regular guests on a preceding program that used to air during this time period. And because of the response to that program, Inside Politics has evolved. You have been extremely critical of Ronald Reagan for the last several months during these broadcasts. Is there anything that Ronald Reagan has done that has surprised you because of its astuteness, as Tom Roser has suggested?
Well, no, he doesn't surprise me because he is an excellent actor, and he's got good script writers now and good directors, and they're giving him a good thing to follow. I really think what's going to happen as we move closer towards the election is you're going to see Anderson, if he stays in the race, becoming the darling of the liberal left, and Reagan having been the darling of the right. And if Carter's people are as smart as Reagan's people in terms of structuring, they'll have the President of the United States coming down the center and running centrist politics, warning the people of not veering to the right or veering to the left, and preserving the two-party system and giving a strong second term to an American president for the first time since Eisenhower, and telling the American people that as bad as things may appear to be, they're certainly better than they should be concerning the, in light of the external pressures from, say, Japan and Germany as producers and the Arab countries as far as charging us for oil, etc.
It would help, would it not, if Mr. Carter knew where the center was? I'm frequently amazed that we're calling for ever larger appropriations in defense, and then we're sort of serenading the spirit of detente the next day, and so I just wonder if Mr. Carter has figured out where the center is, because he sometimes acts as though he's the old saber rattler, and then he evokes the spirit of his speech at Notre Dame where he says that this confrontation with communism is all old hat. So I just have trouble seeing him coming in the center. I agree with your view and wish, evidently, that he would take the center.
Bill Cameron?
Just one thing. The idea of detente and a strong defense are not necessarily in opposition to each other. You might make an analogy to James Bond, that when James Bond makes love, he still keeps his gun next to him.
I won't touch that.
We've only got 8 minutes left. Okay, Bill Cameron?
Presidential elections are popularity contests. People go in the voting booth. They don't remember issues. John Anderson is not going to win this election. Ronald Reagan has a pretty good crack at it, but it's very tough to unseat an incumbent. I think the election is too close to call, despite the poll out yesterday, I think, that puts Reagan far ahead. I think that's people beginning to realize now, my goodness, it's going to be Reagan. Well,
yow.
That's interesting. So I'll vote for him. I mean, all new candidates in the minds of most people do well in the polls when that realization starts hitting that this is the candidate. But I wouldn't risk a guess on this one. And if it does go into the House, of course, it'll be Jimmy Carter again. But I don't see John Anderson winning. And I have a hunch Reagan is probably the next president. But nagging at me is the fact that the incumbent is very difficult to beat.
Was anybody at this table surprised at the way in which John Anderson's remark concerning the natural rhythm of some dancing students in St. Louis was reported by the media? And I would ask the question, how might that story have been reported if Jimmy Carter or Ronald Reagan made the same statement? Tom Roser?
Well, after seeing, I must say, that after seeing John Anderson wooed by the press and lionized by the press, while your candidate, Phil Crone, Mr. Carter, and my candidate, Mr. Reagan, has really taken it on the chin, to see this warm adulation coming out from the electronics meeting and everything else, it was fun, I must say, to see John suffer a little bit by telling these blacks that they had a natural sense of rhythm. Get on, hooray. But
well, they do.
That's very rare for...
That assertion is that it's true.
We're not going to run you for anything. But it's very rare to see John make that gaffe. And, of course, when you say that, then you say, gosh, my guy has done it. He's slurred ethnics. He's slurred Italians. He's done all kinds of terrible things, and we'll do it hideously, I guess, again. So I think John didn't deserve it, but it's sort of fun as long as everybody's getting a poke that he doesn't.
I'm proud to say I covered that news conference with John yesterday over at the Radisson, and like a good reporter, I reported the controversy to both the desk in Chicago and New York, and both had the good sense to turn down coverage of that issue.
Right.
I want to ask you a question, Tom. What did Reagan do in the Second World War? Was he an actor in the Army? Or?
No, what he was, he experienced terrible frontline danger by actually producing training films.
Oh, my God.
And it was at the risk of life and limb, and it was a terrible thing. That was the Great War, Phil, and we don't like to talk about it because of that.
Why do you ask
that's
the question?
True. It was training films.
Is that going to become an issue? Are you going to bring that up as an issue in the coming months on this
May
program?
I be the first.
Okay.
We'll have, what was Carter on, some boat or something at the tail end of the Second
right.
World War?
Right.
Yeah, serving in danger with minefields, right. And there was Reagan doing his training films.
I don't think if you bring up the war record, I mean, George Bush ran his home movies of his war record, and it didn't do him any good.
And Lyndon Johnson was the fellow who was assigned to a very short stint, and also as a result of Uncle Carl, Vincent got some kind of a commission. I think everybody plays games, I think, with that. And go ahead, we'll meet it right head on.
As a Reagan supporter, is the age issue still the one issue that you think is going to be the main one in the coming months?
No, I'm amazed that the age issue has really been passed, I almost said passed away, my God, I don't want to say that.
But never
the
age say issue, passed away with Governor Reagan.
Yes, I'd say the age issue now has transcended the real issues of this campaign. But no, I'm surprised the age issue hasn't been with it. I think the Carter people are going to do is really to sort of get this, in a way, get this guy looking like King Kong. He's going to smash the button down. He's going to mash the button, actually, and blow up the world. What you really ought to concentrate on is the age issue, because we can answer the thing about mashing the button. But the age issue, we got stuck with 69, and that's the way it's going to have to be. So I'd concentrate on that. That's good-natured advice to my good friend over there.
Phil,
I'm going to be making big decisions on the presidential campaign, but... I think what Bill said about the incumbency is important. God knows what can happen in the next 90 days.
Okay, on that note, we are out of time for our first broadcast of Inside Politics. Our guest this evening, Thomas Roser, Vice President of Government Relations for the Quaker Oats Company and President of the City Club of Chicago. He's also the chairman of Project LEAP. Phil Crone has been here. He is an urbanologist and advisor to local Democratic candidates and has been a strategist for them for the last
5 or 6 years in the city of Chicago, and prior to that, he worked for the Republican Party, and he is a former speechwriter for John Lindsay. Our third guest this evening, Bill Cameron, political editor of WMAQ Radio, veteran City Hall reporter, and a political commentator for NBC Radio Network, and also host of his own program every Sunday night at 9 o'clock on WMAQ Radio. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thank you very much for joining us on our first program here on Inside Politics. We'll see you next Thursday night with Dick Ciccone, Sheldon Gardner, and Tim Sheehan. Good night, everybody.
The preceding program was made possible through a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
WBEZ 91.5 WBEZ National Public Radio WBEZ WBEZ Chicago.
Good evening. I'm Sandra Gere, and we have a very special operatic treat for you tonight. Catherine Szyszynski is with us today, and I am so delighted to see you. You were here with the Lyric Opera some months ago. I wonder if you'd tell us what it was like appearing there.
That was my first appearance with the Chicago Lyric in connection with the 25th anniversary gala performances of Gounod's Faust. I was singing with Mirella Freni, Nikolai Gyaurov, Alfredo Krauss, fabulous, unbelievably wonderful artists, Georges Prêtre.